This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am Chris Spangle, leading the charge here as usual, the publisher and editor-in-chief of We Are Libertarians. To my right is co-host Greg Lenz. Greg, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Chris. How are you?
Oh, I'm fantastic. And to my left is Maya Axton, the pink princess of We Are Libertarians. How are you doing?
Oh, princess? I thought it was a queen. You're on your knees.
Well, queens don't generally wear black tutus.
I wear what I want.
In her defense, she accessorized with a gun.
That is true. A very large gun.
I'm a tutu and a 45.
So if you're new to We Are Libertarians, if you haven't had a chance to check out the About the We Are Libertarians podcast, we are a podcast with a companion site where we talk about what we want, and we try to give you a variety of libertarian points of view. Greg is a former...
Dirty Republican.
A scumbag Republican, and has moved and lurched over the last 9 months towards anarchism. And partially responsible for that is the Pink Princess Maya, who is... I don't even know if you're an anarchist. You're so anarchist, you won't even call yourself an anarchist.
Voluntarist.
Yeah, voluntarist.
All right, that's what the anarchists that are too anarchist to call themselves anarchists call themselves.
I would say it's hipsterism of anarchy, right. But I'm afraid to get shot.
Right.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Never say that.
I know.
And I am ever evolving. I sort of play the devil's advocate here and ask a lot of questions of these two that... they answer, and then I give my response, which is usually the correct one. So that is a little bit about...
It's only the correct because you edit out everything else to
That's
make
true.
Yourself sound yeah. right.
That's true. No, I only edit out my ums and my whats, and you know, and so.
And
so
unless Gina's on, and then it's all the curse words.
Yeah. Missing in action, we also have a cast of characters that generally drop by. Gina Martinez is... I guess you'd call her a regular co-host of We Are Libertarians.
There was a time when she was a regular co-host. She's on sabbatical right now.
Right. She's on vacation. She's been in New Orleans, and she's actually back from vacation. And I texted her to be here today. Now, she knows that we record this program every Thursday night, and yet she's on a date.
Yep.
But she just kind of forgets that stuff. So.
Is it a date if it's before 5, though? That's what I can get my head around.
She said she'll be here if her date ends early. I'm like, we're recording at 7. What kind of weird date is this? But it's Gina, so we don't ask questions.
Yeah.
So she...
Time has no place in her world.
So she may drop in here momentarily. Also, Creighton Harrington works at Young Americans for Liberty in D.C., and... used to be a regular, but then he got a real job, and now he can't really come on as much anymore.
Now he's busy winning the messaging war of the shutdown and the debt ceiling discussions.
He's creating events like Yalloween. Some big government is scary. that's such a Creighton joke.
You know, when I saw that, I wasn't sure if that was Creighton, because typically he does the Ernest Too Scary movie or reference around Halloween. Like,
right.
that's what it would have looked like. It would have been a picture of Ernest.
So that is just a small tad bit about We Are Libertarians. Check out WeAreLibertarians.com. If you want to know a little bit more, we often throw up some writings. You've written a couple pieces this week, Greg.
Yeah.
Tell us some of the things that they can find on WeAreLibertarians.com.
Joe Ruiz and I co-authored a piece this week kind of giving our take on the government shutdown and essentially the political messaging war. And then I just wanted to give a brief guide, kind of an idiot's guide to the debt ceiling, if you will. Today, actually.
Yeah, and we also interviewed Julie Borowski, token libertarian girl, and you can hear that interview in the feed, or if you're just somehow not able to get the feed for whatever reason, I don't know, go to WeAreLibertarians.com. And
Julie B., thank you for coming on and talking with us on behalf of myself and Maya.
It was great to talk to her. So, inside joke. So, check it out. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter. We have a subreddit, We Are Libertarians. So, lots of ways to interact. And this is going to be a bit of an interactive show. We're going to talk about the debt ceiling first. We're going to give you some of the basic information and talk about that a little bit. But after that, we have been stockpiling your questions. So, I'm not sure what happened over the last, 2 weeks, but we've gotten several questions sent in of things that people would like answered. So we're going to read some of those questions and give you some of those answers. We were going to do a call-in show, but it just was like, all right, we've got, 20 topics with these questions here. So we didn't want to overwhelm ourselves or you, the listener, because let's be honest, this podcast is all about you.
Exactly.
The listener, right.
Well, see, the thing is, that's why one of the sister shows of this network and this show, The Uncontrollables, is a live call-in show.
That's
so
right.
If you want to talk to the smartest person in the We Are Libertarians network, you can call into my show.
My show.
You know what? So you're a voluntarist populist. You're about the people, letting them call in.
No, I'm a misanthrope. I hate everyone.
Right.
But it's entertaining as hell to hear idiots call in and try to outthink me.
Hey, I called in this week. That's not nice.
Yeah, you used the name Dave. Congratulations, Chris.
Yeah. If you want to find out some of our... if you can go to iTunes and search WAL Radio Network, or you can go to WAL-radio.com and find all the podcasts that we do in the network. So we just have a few new listeners I see in the subscriptions, so wanted to get everybody up to speed on who we are and what we do. So thank you for allowing us that indulgence. So let's move on to the debt ceiling. Let's talk about what the debt ceiling is, should it be abolished, and then how do we get out of this mess? Is it something that we ought to seriously worry about? So let's start out with what the debt ceiling is. Now, Greg, you wrote the We Are Libertarians Guide to the Debt Ceiling for WeAreLibertarians.com. Tell us a little bit about what the debt ceiling is.
All it really is a hard limit on how much debt the Treasury can issue on behalf of the American people. It wasn't until about 1917 that we had it. That's when they instituted it, because they didn't want to see us getting in a situation where the Treasury could just say, well, we're just going to up the number of auctions we have and auction away as much debt as possible, and then have the American people holding all, essentially being responsible for repaying all
of it. It was also a functionary thing as well, because up to that point, whenever the executive branch needed to execute the payments for the things that Congress had authorized, they had to go, if they needed to create debt, okay, they would have to go back to the Congress and have that debt authorized. So it became cumbersome when the Congress passes a bill that something needs to be paid for. They're passing it with the knowledge that this is not paid for. You're going to have to create debt to pay for that. And then the executive branch has to execute the payments, but then they've got to go back to Congress to get the debt paid for. So it becomes circular. And that's sort of what we have going on now. The debt ceiling is not about what is going to be paid for. That is under the purview of the Congress. This is about the Treasury being able to prioritize what Congress has already mandated ought to be paid. So they created the debt limit to put a cap on that, and they said, hey, Treasury, do what you need to do. And if you issue a debt up to this point, then you've got to come back and get authorization. So that's the origins of the debt ceiling.
Yep, and it had not really become a political tool until about 1995, when there was that Republican Revolution with Gingrich and the quote-unquote ditto-head Congress. And it had been under the Gephardt rule for pretty much most of the 19th or the last century. The 20th century.
The
Gephardt rule was that essentially when Congress passes a budget, because they are saying this is what we're appropriating, it's deemed passed a debt limit raise, because we've agreed to spend this much. This is what the Treasury has to send out in payments. The debt limit really is irrelevant at that point, because they already have to send out the money that we've agreed to appropriate. Then Newt and there's that revolution, and all of a sudden they want that hard limit to get spending under control.
Right. So that's sort of the history of it. So at this point, we're now facing a situation where the Republicans are using it as a, the president says, using it as a weapon and saying, we're not going to raise the debt limit. If they don't raise the debt limit, what happens then?
First things first, we don't technically default as long as we pay the interest on our outstanding sovereign debt and debt we owe to the Federal Reserve. So as long as we can meet those obligations through tax revenues, we don't enter default. Problem is, since we borrow, I think it's about one out of every $4 we spend, everything else takes back seat. So got to service the debt. After that, it's all right. Here's what's left over of the pie. Take your cuts.
Now, part of the problem with that is one of the arguments floating around is that, hey, and Toomey, Pat Toomey, the senator, has a bill on the floor that speaks to this. Every month, what we bring in and what the debt service payment going out, they match up. So why not? What is the crisis if we bring in enough to pay what we need to pay? The problem is the government must settle accounts at the end of every single day. It's not on a monthly or a weekly basis. It's on a daily basis. And so the amount of tax revenues that are collected and the amount of payments that need to be made on a daily basis don't match up. It wildly spikes. And so you're not able to actually just bring something in, pay it out. It's not
in the business
clean
world.
Like
it's what's known as like a cash flow crunch.
Right.
Like you have a lot of accounts receivables, but it's not till, you know, net 30 terms, so 30 days from now, but all of a sudden they're due.
Social Security is due a very large payment at the beginning of the next month, and so they can't just say, okay, let it go. The revenues will take care of the interest payments.
Yeah, so it's not like it's a consistent flow every day. They have different obligations they have to meet, and they only have X amount of cash on hand.
Well, it's hard when you think that the fact that the government doesn't believe in saving, so they could never build up a surplus of any kind and then be able to use brought-in revenues to pay the daily issues. But
right.
When they borrow massive amounts of money, they're like, you know, we've been making it work for this long. Let's just keep going like
right.
The way we're going. Why build up a nice little savings so we can handle this without panic? But
well, and there are
about?
a lot of Republicans and probably some libertarians, too, that will say anytime you have savings as a government, that's our money, so send it back to us. That's not what Mitch Daniels in Indiana believed, and Indiana has actually had a large surplus of reserves of tax money, and that's one of the reasons that the Indiana state government has been solvent compared to other states like Illinois.
Everyone around us.
Right. Every state around us has suffered with the payments that are, especially pensions, things like that, insurance payments. Indiana has weathered the storm of the recession better than our neighbors, and that's actually brought us a lot of business here in Indiana, so
yeah.
Which helps brings up tax rolls. So October 17th is the magical date. That is 7 days from the date of this recording. What happens on that date? So at 11:59, do we just, like, does catastrophe befall America?
You mean like during a government shutdown?
No.
No, because that's
like, oh, wait.
Government shutdown, like,
really?
They closed some national parks.
They promised it would be catastrophic.
Right.
And there'd be panic in the streets. Are you telling me that the debt ceiling could be the same way? Really? Are the same people telling you that?
There's several different studies, and they, like, I really think the hard date's November 1st. I really do. That's when pretty much every person has every study says that that's when we're really out of cash, and that's when prioritization of what debt you're going to actually pay becomes the issue.
And the partial shutdown, we're not going to call it even a shutdown because 17% of the government is staying home collecting a paycheck that they'll get in the future.
I like to call it the government siesta.
It's a little nap
for parts of the government.
So on November 1st, it's kind of probably extended a little bit. It's helped. What happens on November 1st if they don't have an agreement?
On November 1st, that's when, I mean, interest on the debt takes number one priority. So that's what they will have to pay first. That if they don't pay that, we technically do go into default. And that's when other countries could call their debt due that they've lent us. I mean, in bankruptcy, that's like when in the private sector, like if a company couldn't meet their debt obligations, you start selling off assets. Now, governments don't do that. So I don't know what they'll do. Or at that point, the president with the 14th Amendment, if he interprets it that way and he gets legal coverage from his attorneys, that's when he just decides to unilaterally raise the debt limit, since the 14th Amendment says the debt of the United States can never be questioned.
Couldn't they also nationalize certain things to pull in money?
Could they nationalize certain things to pull in money? Like, for instance, the banks?
Anything. Couldn't they take money from the banks since the Federal Reserve issues them a couple extra trillion dollars of capital to sit on that hasn't been monetized yet? But
I don't know that they would. The president would do that because that's totally outside the bounds of the Constitution. What he would probably
Hold on.
There are interpretations. He has not done anything that's just a absolute no. Like, there's legal interpretation for everything he's going to do. So what he'd probably do is print that trillion-dollar coin they floated around last time and then draw on that.
Okay. So do you think that the government will actually default on its loan?
No way ever.
Right.
Ever. I mean, the first thing they do is pay the interest on their debt payments and then tell Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid and the defense budget, sorry, these are mandatory cuts. We don't have enough money.
Could they technically just pass a bill that says they raise the debt ceiling only as much as is needed as to pay the interest payments?
They absolutely. Congress could, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they could basically still use the debt ceiling being raised as a political issue or a political, you know, tool, but raise it just enough to cover interest payments.
Yep, absolutely. The Congress could.
Now, that seems very logical and smart. So, obviously, we know Congress will not do that.
Has that discussion taken place.
Right. If we could just get Congress people to listen to this program.
Now, then again, with the debt ceiling and the debt of the country, I mean, we're sitting at about $120 trillion in debt.
That's entitlements going forward. Not yet.
That's money we hypothetically owe. Now, hold on. Right. But that's still debt. There's a bill coming. The bill's in the mail. It just hasn't gotten here yet.
Right.
We still have that debt, period.
Well, to give you some perspective, okay, we have $17 trillion in debt, okay, actual debt. If you take all the currency in the entire world and add it together, it's somewhere between $45 and $50 trillion, or $50 trillion. So that's a pretty sizable chunk. That's, you know, what, at least a third? You're the math guy.
Yeah, at least a third.
Of the world's currency in our debt. So
actual, like, printed currency.
And that's not adjusted for exchange rates.
Currency. Just, like,
cash in pocket currency.
No, green pieces of paper.
Yeah.
valueless.
All money that exists on the planet is about $50 trillion.
Okay.
I'm including, you know, fake money and, you know, the electronic transfers and all that. So what has been printed and issued by governments and central banks is $50 trillion. We have a debt of $17 trillion. Today, Harry Reid, actually, I think it was yesterday, said that to be concerned about the debt is anarchy. You're just an anarchist if you're concerned about the debt. Maya, would you like to tackle that?
Historically, the word anarchist has been used as a big, scary boogeyman word.
Right.
So if you care about something that we don't... If you're not for absolute statism, you're an anarchist to these people.
It is so scary to trust other individuals to the point of allowing them to live their life. You're the boogeyman.
Right.
You mean like going into a grocery store without police escorts?
Right.
Man, that's some scary crap right there. I mean, imagine walking to Whole Foods without an AK-47.
What would happen?
Somebody has along the way told poor old sad Harry Reid that anarchy is like a good slur, and so he just is using it all the time. Like, he's just, it's sort of weird and sad, but that's...
No, you look up anarchy in most dictionaries, and this is how people use it against people in the political scene all the time, is that you look it up, it's either A, defined by chaos,
right,
or defined against just being anti-authority.
It's the guys in the masks throwing, you know, Molotov cocktails in France and causing all kinds of problems.
Well, those dirty black reds over there, but yeah.
Right. So
I'll be honest, though. Back in December, like when I first came on the show, I had that negative connotation until I really did my research.
Right. Now, I mean, she walked in with bright pink hair, a black tutu, and a gun. I mean, anarchy literally walked into my living room, and I have no problem with
it.
It
looks damn good.
I know. Oh. So explain briefly what anarchy is for the people out there who may not have that Greg Lynn's view of what anarchism actually is.
Anarchy in the context of politics and a political philosophy is without leaders. Basically saying there's no one to elect. And leaders being defined in this context as people that are elected that hold arbitrary power over an arbitrary line drawn in the sand. It's basically all it really means. It doesn't mean there's no rules. It doesn't mean that there's no systems of
governance,
of collective governance. not actual like defined in power governance, but contract law. And by contract law, every time you sign a piece of paper, that's a contract. You have agreed to the terms of the contract. That is now law in between you and the other people on the contract. Right. It goes back to a grocery store. It's basically like walking in a grocery store.
Except you have options. So if you don't like that contract or that system of governance,
go to another one. It's like walking in a grocery store. You walk into Walmart, go, man, this place sucks. I'm going to Kroger.
Yep.
Right.
Imagine if you could do that with your
there
government.
There is order, and it's a concept called spontaneous order. And order and structure always is born out of chaos. And we're talking about voluntary order as opposed to force, which is what government is. So if you're interested in the concept of anarchy, it is the pure, logical, consistent philosophy. It's like if you're taking the libertarian philosophy to its very end point, a stateless society is where you land. Now, some people, probably like our friend Greg here, look at it pragmatically and say, okay, that is great, but we can't have that at this point, so here's what we can negotiate down to. So
I mean, maybe we can. I just don't know yet. Right. I don't know if I've trusted enough people yet.
And I've used the word context like five times already now,
right.
But that's the most important part about talking about anarchy is that it's not about Somalia or any other country in the world. It's about right here, right now, present-day America, that many of us think that anarchy is possible, and not for all 330 million inhabitants of this country. Not everyone will agree with anarchy. Not everyone's prepared to deal with something as, I think, as possibly difficult as living your life responsibly and dealing with the consequences of your own actions without
That's
any
my
kind
concern.
Of parachutes.
Right.
That is a very difficult thing for most people to even try to bring into their imagination that, oh my God, I would have to, you know, think about everything in my life and have a way to deal with it instead of just assuming the government's going to take care of me.
We only vote at like 50%. Can you imagine the participation in
self-governance? I think it's like 30% actually. But yeah. All right, we've diverted off to a tangent.
Sorry.
If you want to know more about anarchy and anarchism and voluntarism.
Voluntarism.
Yeah, I can't say it. TheUncontrollables.com and hit my up on Facebook, although you might regret it.
Be informed.
be warned that if you like Maya's Facebook page, you will see cuss words.
Can I call it the true no-spin zone without
right.
Maya getting mad?
I'll take that because O'Reilly is a salesman, and I have mad amounts of respect for that man. That he can be such an idiot and so ignorant and be so powerful.
Is he the Kardashian of Fox News?
Yes.
All right. So anarchy will, if we hit November 1st or October 17th and we default on our loans, does anarchy ensue?
No. As long as we make our debt payments, everything's fine.
Okay.
It just things get cuts.
Now, I don't believe that we're going to default for 1 second because there's a couple things at play. There's fiat currency, and we'll talk about that in just 1 second. And the second is defaulting and losing the full faith and credit of the United States means that this government is over. And what powerful centralized government like the United States will ever freely, voluntarily give up their hold on power?
Republicans and Democrats hate each other, but they're not kamikazes.
Right.
You know.
So fiat currency was the other idea that I floated. Can you explain what fiat currency is? And is that what we have, Maya Axton?
Yeah, it's basically it's a currency that has no backing. There's no value to the currency other than what somebody says it is. So it's basically
trust.
Yeah, it's trust. So basically it's like me going and grabbing some money out of a Monopoly game and then you believing me when I tell you that you can take the money I'm handing you and go spend it somewhere else.
Right.
And a fiat currency, the assigned value to that currency is subject to change on a minute-to-minute basis.
When you get currency, it's actually called a treasury note, and the treasury promises to pay you the value of what that is worth. Now, we used to have the gold standard, so every single issuance of currency was backed by gold, a hard metal, an actual physical thing that there was a limited amount on planet Earth of gold. And so you couldn't inflate the price of gold. The price of gold just was gold, what it was trading at in the market. Now, with currency, the value of your dollar can be inflated by just printing it.
And that's exactly what the Federal Reserve System did, is with they when they can print as much money as they can. I kind of referenced that earlier, where they can, the Federal Reserve is not part of the federal government. It's a collection of private banks. go chase Morgan. But it can print as much money as it wants to, and it can actually just kind of store it in banks for release whenever they want. That's what quantitative easing is the right. issuing of massive amounts of currency. And that's the issue. And they also, when you go back to gold standard, that what's why you think when you collect old coins is that they still have a silver melt value. Right. Is that most coins were made out of a precious metal because no matter what happened, they were always worth something.
So to give you an illustrative point of what removing ourselves from the gold standard has meant to our currency, in 100 years ago, you could take two gold coins, and you could take those two gold coins, and you could go buy two nice suits in 1913 at your local tailoring store. And the cost of those suits was probably $20, okay? $20 or two gold coins. Today, those two same suits would be two gold coins, but the suit's quality has not changed, the gold's quality have not changed, but the paper currency has changed. And do you have any idea what the price of gold is?
Right now, I believe it's like 108, or no, like it's a 1,800 an ounce, maybe?
Right.
$1,800 an ounce,
so we're looking
there.
At about $2,000 for those suits as opposed to $20. So that is, and if you look at the price of inflation since 1971 when we went off the gold standard, I think it was 71, maybe 72.
71. Because that's when the Libertarian Party was started.
Right. The Libertarian Party was actually formed by a group of Goldwater conservatives who were so pissed off at the Republican Party and the removal of the government from the gold standard
that they started
the LP.
Let me correct. It wasn't 1800.
What is it?
We're definitely wrong. It's dropped quite generously. It's 1287.40.
Okay.
As of the close of business today.
Okay. So, $2,400 suits versus $20 suits.
The best way is when we implemented a minimum wage, and this is the best for left libertarians and liberals. Right now, the minimum wage, if we not inflated the currency, would be about $22.13 an hour.
Right. So you're just seeing your money and. You know, fiat currency has a propensity to collapse.
Weimar Republic much?
Even more currently is that we used to give out these notes during the Rupert's campaign is we had a $100 trillion paper note from Zimbabwe.
Right.
Because they have a fiat currency and they kept issuing more and more and more and more. And they actually had one day where it went from you could go buy an apple with a $100 bill. By the end of the day, I think you were having to use $500 billion note.
Yep.
In one day.
They couldn't even keep paper in stock. And finally the money wasn't even worth what the paper was printed on. So it was pointless and fruitless to print money anymore, so they just went to electronic bank accounts. And finally it collapsed. So
and that's what we're facing. In all reality, that's what we're going to do with our debt.
Right.
Because a government, as long as you don't get hyperinflation, will inflate away its debt.
Who is the largest holder of United States debt?
China, a collection of other countries, Japan.
Japan and China are right around at like $1.1 trillion or so.
The Federal Reserve owns a ton.
Right. The Federal Reserve, the private collection of U.S. banks, as Maya stated, which is neither federal nor a reserve of any sort, owns the most treasury notes, most of the United States debt. So we are buying our own debt, and we are monetizing our own debt, which means we're just rolling the number of money in the world up.
Assuming we never get to a point where there's a contentious relationship.
Right.
Because if we ever decided to decharter them, we would still be owed.
So,
or they would still be owed.
Facing the prospect of hyperinflation, it's very important that the United States not default on anything, that the myth of the United States government, and I say myth in a neutral term, not negative or positive, the trust in that reserve note, the currency of the world, the blood of the world's financial system, trust must remain in the U.S. dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Because if trust is lost, if people think that the United States government cannot pay their bills, then panic sets in, runs on banks take place, and the entire global financial system collapses.
Well, see, the other thing is that I'm going to bring it up again on this show, is that like the BRICS nations, have been working and buying up gold. Look at India, was for a while the biggest buyer of gold. The Philippines is on its way up now.
Brazil, Russia, India, China.
Russia, India, China, and South Africa.
Okay.
BRICS. It's five capital letters. It used to just be the BRIC nations, BRC. Yeah. Now it's BRCS. Apostrophe. But,
which was a shock. That's boring, but that was shocking when that was added.
It's a huge statement, and they're getting ready to maybe drop India for Indonesia. India's been having some massive problems. But is that they've been working with a lot of other major growing economic powerhouses, and they're pushing. And one of the main reasons they started was to go away from the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar basically backs everything in the entire world, and it is the economic lifeblood of the entire world.
Russia and China have continuously worked together to find escape routes.
But they're so corrupt, neither of them can be considered, so they go to the Australians.
Well, so what they've done is they've tried to, like, they exchange goods in their own currencies at this point. They've released themselves from the dollar, and basically, Russia and China own a lot of our debt, and so there was a point in the meltdown period where the Chinese Treasury Secretary came to Washington, D.C., like right in the middle of all this, of the meltdown in late 2008, and they had a state dinner, and the Chinese premier basically said, you better get this fixed, because the only thing that stands between Russia completely dumping all of its debt and making a run on your banks is us. And that scared Hank Paulson to the bone, and that's when, you know, we had to suspend free market principles to save the free market system.
To save the investment banks.
Right.
So, now, I still contend the Arab Spring was entirely a result of quantitative easing. Because
really?
When you are the default currency, everybody else's currency is pegged off of yours. So let's say there's just 100 U.S. dollars in the world. All of a sudden, overnight, there's 300. That means that all of your currencies triple as well. Well, subsidies are a huge part of Middle Eastern food policy. They subsidize oil and they subsidize food. And so what happened was the subsidies stayed the same. The food prices skyrocketed when Bernanke increased the monetary supply. And that's when you saw all the civil unrest.
Right.
And that's if you look at the history of who we've attacked as nations, you'll notice that they're countries that have tried or have tried to go back to a gold standard. One of the most recent is Libya,
mm-hmm.
Not wanting to be of the Federal Reserve banking system, and they were trying to go back to the gold standard. It just so happened right about that time we decided we didn't like Gaddafi enough, and we decided to murder him. Huh, weird kind of how that works out.
Gaddafi had a tremendous amount of gold. There is a couple books. There's a guy named John Perkins. Look him up on Netflix.
Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
John Perkins and some of the documentaries that he's been a part of, and his dealings as an economic hitman on third world countries for the IMF.
With Bain Capital, shockingly.
And
though.
Bain Capital. It's really shocking stuff, and it's a lesser known part. And it kind of puts into perspective why, you know, people like Chavez rise to power by being anti-American.
Conceptually, it's no different than mob extortion.
Right.
It was, listen, we're going to give you $100 million in loans. You're going to use that to build out economic infrastructure and energy supply. You're going to pay us back. When they defaulted, which they knew they would because it was based on false projections, we're going to build a military base here and control you.
And we basically, through default, are going to end up controlling all of your nation's resources.
Mm-hmm. And if you decide to be populist, we're going to support a dictator that will oppress you for a long
right.
time.
Right. So, very, very happy stuff.
Yeah.
So we, but I think it's important at this time to kind of revisit that. A lot of libertarians may be listening going, okay, guys, I get it. But for those new to the libertarian philosophy or interested in it, you've got to understand fiat currency. You've got to understand that trust in the Federal Reserve currency of the United States, and how much that plays a role in all this. These guys in Washington, D.C. all understand that, and that's why they're not actually going to let anything default. But should there be a default, it could be absolutely catastrophic.
And the thing to remember is is that this country isn't going to be number one for that much longer. It's not feasible for are any of the projections for the next 50 years for us to stay on top where we're at. I'm not saying it's going to take 50 years for us to fall, but going to other countries like BRICS, and you've got a bunch of other countries out there that are forming coalitions and saying, why do we care about the United States anymore?
Right.
And why do we allow them to tell us what to do? Why do we allow them to bully us around? And that, well, the kids that are being picked on are starting to stand up. And yeah, we might make it a couple more years if we keep raising our debt ceiling and, you know, getting out of shutdowns. But all in all, we're not going to be a first world nation for much longer.
One of the books that I command every person, if you are listening
command?
To my, if you are listening to my voice, I command you by force.
Zig
Hill. As president of all the libertarians,
as president of this community, the president, the head honcho of this hacienda, I command you to get How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes by Peter and Adam Schiff. Adam? No, that's not right. But Andrew Schiff. This book is easy to read. You can read it in 2 hours.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's got pictures.
You can read it in the back of an RV on a trip to Las Vegas.
Right. It's brilliant. And basically, it walks you through how an economy grows and what causes it to crash. And basically, the reason that it crashes, spoiler alert, is China. Once China figures out that they can just sell their crappy trinkets to their middle class that they've grown, then they don't need us anymore. And
see, I disagree with that, because creating a middle class creates a wealthy class, or quote unquote wealthy class, which right. means political influence, and they will never allow that.
That is true.
Well, it's not just China anymore. Mm-hmm. Remember, look at India, look at Russia. Look at all the different countries. Look at Brazil. It's not about their middle class, the trinkets they're making. Look at the amount of natural resources those five countries control.
If we would just access their ours, we'd put them to shame.
With the growth of manufacturing in China and India, the growth of manufacturing and processing in Brazil, you've got South America or South Africa, which has been doing leaps and bounds better. You've got Russia, which is a powerhouse of mental power.
Confidence.
They seriously are. They're some of the most advanced people, and they always have been. They're kind of like the Germans, except a little bit more devious. And with those five countries combined, with the amount of people and natural resources they have, they'll leave us in the dust, because we've always had to import a great amount of resources. But in their network and their union, they win. They win by default.
See, this is where we disagree a bit, just because I think it's highly unlikely politically they'd intertwine. There are vast differences between those countries.
It's not politically.
No, I mean, it makes sense.
At that point, they don't really care about politics. Imagine treating BRICS like the United States should have been treated, a collection of 50 different states. Imagine BRICS like the original 13 colonies.
But I don't think they can operate under an existing, like an Articles of Confederation, essentially, or a European
Union. No, they
Union.
Won't. They'll go, hey, I have these resources. Hey, you have this. Let's do it.
Oh, if you're right.
To crush the stranglehold of the Eurozone and the United States. Now, also on top of that, you got to think, all of those nations purposely suppress their market and their number, their market's figures. We have no, we really, really, like Peter Schiff probably is the best person to speak on a lot of this stuff about the suppression of the Chinese market, is that we really have no idea what they're worth and what's going on in their country, because they suppress the crap out of everything. And that's a huge thing, because if they come out and they turn off the whole suppression mechanism and they let it go, we're done. They can call on us and we won't be able to call their bluff.
It's actually it's a little known fact that China actually carries more debt than we do per capita. They keep it off the books, and they're actually older demographically than we are, and they have no government insurance programs for their elderly. So, like, a lot of times you hear China's the big red scare, blah, 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 blah. No doubt, they are the world's second biggest political powerhouse, assuming you don't count the European Union. But they are in a worse shape with their demographics than we are, and their debt is higher than ours.
The thing is, they don't care.
No, they don't.
All right. So that is the great debate on China and the BRICS nations. So let's move on to some of our questions. So hopefully you know a little bit more about our current financial situation and where we may be headed.
There's something we should add into that. So if you're talking about wanting to teach new listeners,
okay,
it's about not just the $17 trillion on the debt ceiling, but what that $120 trillion really kind of comes from. The two biggest parts is Medicare and Social Security. Medicare, they're estimating up to $90 trillion on its own. I think they're looking at least $18 trillion for Social Security, and that's unfunded liabilities. Stuff we have to pay out, we have no way, we don't have any idea how we're going to pay for it.
Right.
Then you've got
Oh, sure we do. You inflate the currency.
Yeah, there you go.
It's just like when England when George Soros broke the English pound and they doubled the amount of currency overnight.
Yeah.
That's what we'll do.
Right now, in 2010, you had $50 billion a year in military pensions. They're expecting that to over double in the next 15 years.
A combination of cuts and inflation. The United States, I don't have the same view because they're too much of a power center and there's no single country that could ever remotely dominate the world. Like a collection of countries, yes, but a single power, no. There's no one close. So I don't have the same view from the perspective that the United States will inflate. They'll have some political quote-unquote cuts and changes to entitlement programs, and it'll be business as usual.
All right, so...
Just that's me personally, though. You're totally valid.
Remember, England, that tiny little crap hole ruled the world.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. You could be right.
I am right.
It's a coin flip.
World economics, I own this show.
All right. Moving on to our first question. So we've been building up a lot of questions, and we want to make sure we get to them. If you want to write us questions, send them in to editor@wearelibertarians.com. That goes to me. Or you can go to our Facebook page, and you can send them in that way through the messages. And then we'll answer them from time to time. So Nick writes, "Hi, I'm a very big fan, even though I only have been listening for a couple months." Well, that is fantastic, and thank you.
Thank you, Nick.
Spread the word. Maya says F you.
Tough love.
I like to usually classify myself as a minarchist and sometimes classical liberal, if there is a difference. However, I do believe that the best way to preserve freedom is to have some kind of state, which a constitution or something similar.
He's a constitutional Republican is what he is.
I do think that it is important that people realize the effects of the 16th and 17th Amendments. These amendments, in my opinion, were one of the defining moments of our fall of freedom. I don't know if you have done a podcast on this, but I was wondering what your opinions were on these amendments. And I would say constitutional Republican and minarchist are fairly close if you look up the definition. That was sort of, in my opinion, the goal of the founders was to create a minarchist state.
A minarchist is basically somebody that believes that no matter, it needs to be small, but there has to be a government.
Right, for courts, for
it doesn't necessarily matter
powers,
what for,
like
just
that.
Has to be a monopolization on the initiation of force.
Right. All right. So let's give the listeners the definitions of the 16th and 17th Amendment. And it is a time it's pertinent because it was the 100th anniversary of the income tax here recently. So Article 16, Amendment 16 says, "The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration." And Amendment 17 was, "The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, elected by the people thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most unanimous branch of the state legislatures. When vacancies happen," blah, blah, blah. So the first, the 16th Amendment, was the income tax amendment.
At the same exact time of the passing of the 16th Amendment, they established the Federal Reserve System.
Right. So let's
that was the real.
Let's take these two separately because they are separate, but they were passed at roughly the same time. 16th Amendment was ratified on. It was passed by Congress, July 2nd, 1909. Ratified February 3rd, 1913. And the 17th Amendment passed by Congress May 13, 1912, ratified April 8, 1913. So within just a couple months of each other. So the income tax. Why was the income tax destructive to the United States of America?
Because it taxes income. I mean, it taxes incentive, basically. It gets rid of the idea that there's an incentive to work harder. At the time that it was passed and instituted, it was only, 1% on the top 1%?
Who
and
made, more than $100,000 in 1913?
Very few people paid it at that point in time.
Like Rockefeller and Carnegie and Morgan.
They promised that most people would never pay it and that it would never grow larger. But as it's proven with any sort of government, that it does nothing but grow.
It's like cancer. It just keeps multiplying and dividing.
No, you can cure cancer.
You can't cure government.
No, you have to kill it. But all of them. but it basically established that no matter what source of income, and that's why from any source derived, it means that through investments, through the hourly rate, salary rate,
arbitrage of goods,
company profits, any kind of way that you bring money in, actually certain kinds of gifts can be taxed, inheritance that kind of rolled into that being allowed, all kinds of things. It's just the government gave itself away to basically take money from everybody.
Now, I did say that it couldn't be like a direct tax on property, and that's where it got muddled in a lot of Supreme Court cases like Pollock later on. It was really just supposed to be for the very rich. Was that its intention?
It was. Well, as with anything, most things with government, there's...
But wait, there's more.
There's usually more to it. Whenever they... All throughout history, whenever they pass something... That's not its final resting place. They know it. They pass it when they think they can get it. Like they write it up and they shrink it down to where they think they get it passed. And they know right if they get it passed, they can make it bigger.
Oh, it's just their foot in the door. That's the precedent.
Just look at, because especially now that we have really good records on it, just look at the past 10 years, every bill we've passed, none of them have stayed the same size. They've all grown in power and scope. And that's,
except the Bill of Rights. Those have gone down.
yeah. But that's basically what the 16th Amendment did, and it didn't take long, and I used to know all these numbers, but in the 20s it really picked up. In the 30s, all the way up through the Second World War.
It started out at 7% of the top 1%,
yeah.
And that was it. That was it. The top 1% of taxpayers paid 7%, and then World War One hit, and it went up. I mean, I think for the top 1% of income, it was really high. I don't want to give a number because I'll be completely wrong.
But it's irrelevant. The point's what matters. Yeah.
Right. You know, Woodrow Wilson said when he was trying to get this passed, oh, it'll never go above 7%.
And that's then, the like, danger of progressives.
Like a year later, it was incredibly high.
Like first it's, oh, we've got to collectivize because we're so poor in FDR. Then the 80s happened, we have to collectivize because we're so rich.
Right.
There's never a reason for those people to not want to collectivize.
Right. Let's go to the next question, or the next amendment, which is the election of the two senators.
Probably one of the worst amendments ever.
Right. The purpose of the Senate, the way that the two houses were built in the Constitution, the House was to represent the people, the passions of the people, and the Senate was designed to cool the passions of the people. The Senate was designed to be deliberate. The Senate was designed to slow the process down. So when you hear people complain about how slow government is, how slow our republic is, it was designed that way, especially the Senate. And up until this amendment, all of the
senators,
all of the senators were elected by the state legislatures. And the state legislatures would send their people to represent the states at the United States Senate. Now, the point of this is that we were built as a federal government, okay? So the Articles of Confederation were a confederation of the states, okay? Independent little nations agreeing that this is what we'll do. It didn't quite work out so well.
It was like the Euro.
Exactly. And so what they decided to do was to create a federal government. And that's where you got the anti-federalists versus the federalists. Some people were against it. Some people were for it. But the main notion was that the 13 states are creating this federal government. The states are creating the government. The people are not creating the government. The states are. Okay. All sovereignty still remains with the states. They listed in the Constitution 17 specific things that the federal government may do. May, meaning they don't have to, but they can. This is what you are allowed to do. And then in the 9th and 10th Amendment, they said, everything else is relegated to the states. The federal government has no power beyond these 17 specific things, and anything not specifically enumerated or specified in this constitution is relegated back to the states. Over time, almost immediately, that little bastard Alexander Hamilton, the notion of nationalism crept in. So you've got anti-federalism versus federalism. And then the notion of nationalism starts to creep in. Manifest Destiny played a part in this. This is why libertarians have a problem with Lincoln. Lincoln was a nationalist. Lincoln said, we must preserve the Union at all costs, including starting a war that will kill 850,000 Americans. So, you know, every other nation on the planet that had African slavery ended slavery within that century peacefully, except the United States. And it was because we were stuck to the idea that we were an exceptional nation and the Union must be preserved. And by any means necessary, even those are terrible. Now, so the argument of of the Civil War was really about that. Slavery, no doubt, was...
It was that the economic benefit of adhering to states' rights.
Right. And it was a great moral outrage, and it is the timber that fueled that fire. But the argument, the political argument of the day leading up to the Civil War was really about states' rights. Where does the power reside? Is it within the people that make up the nation of the United States, or is it in the states themselves where the power is held? Now, over time, obviously, the Federalist lost that completely. And now we view ourselves as one nation. We view the United States like we view France or Great Britain. We don't view ourselves as Indiana or California that are made up of this federation of states. So one of the proposals of the Socialist Party that developed in the early 1900s, led by Eugene Debs, actually here in Indianapolis, and Terre Haute, the Socialist Party platform that he ran on, one of the planks was removing that qualification, making sure that the people elect senators, because that will help speed up the process of change. Because the people in a democracy will always side with free stuff without giving consideration to how it will be paid for.
It's the de Tocqueville argument,
right?
You know?
Explain that.
Alexis de Tocqueville said, once they figure out that they can vote themselves spoils, your democracy will end.
Right. And boy, doesn't that sound familiar today when we're facing $120 trillion in debt, essentially.
If you just shut up about it, I'll give you a free phone.
Okay, yeah. All right.
Vote for me.
Can I have my free phone now?
No.
I shut up.
Sorry.
So that was part of their platform because they want more democracy. Part of part of what they wanted was also referendi. Referendums... It's socialism.
You mean like that thing in Switzerland right now where they're trying to vote in every adult gets a $2,800 a month paycheck?
Right.
Oh.
In California, the state.
We need that here, right?
Right.
We need
that. I agree.
I actually think that would be better than creating the federal monster we have.
Just giving out free money?
I kind of do.
You know what they also did earlier is that they had a referendum and it's called the 1-to-12 rule that any executive can only make per month what the lowest paid salary employee makes per year.
No doubt it's a trapdoor. No, I get it. But, like, also, referenda, I give you California, Proposition 8, not allowing gay marriage. I mean, it's a two-edged sword.
So, California, yeah, exactly right. But that is the reason for referendum, because...
It's direct democracy.
Yeah, it's direct democracy, and that is not part of the American system. I would invite everybody to, if you want to be a real nerd, look up the 1902 Socialist Party platform. It was held in Indianapolis, and read their planks, and you'll go, oh crap, we've elected those people as president the last 43 and 44.
Now,
are the realization of their platform.
Even a cool history lesson on top of that, a current history lesson is that one of our elected representatives from Indiana, representing us in D.C. to a degree, is, I think, what, the only openly socialist member of Congress?
Really?
No, yeah. You're talking about Bernie Sanders from Vermont?
No, I'm talking about our very large bald-headed, dark-skinned feller from Indianapolis.
Oh, ideologically, he's a socialist, but he runs under the Democrat platform.
Then we also still yet have a Socialist Party of Indiana.
Right.
And who is it? It's John Strinka?
Yeah, they're real characters.
He is a wacko bird.
Yes.
Not Justin Amash.
I've been on a couple podcasts with him. I think he's hilarious.
Oh, yeah. Nice guy.
Okay. So, yes, we agree with you. These are incredibly destructive amendments towards our Constitution and our constitutional republic. So, boom. All right. Jason writes in. He works in the scientific field, and he does a lot of research. Now he writes, I would like to hear how scientific research would be affected by the incremental implementation of a more libertarian governance. I have worked both in academic, i.e. publicly funded, and private molecular biology biochemistry research, and currently work in an academic lab studying leukemia. I hope to begin my PhD next fall, but being a libertarian, I feel like this subject is a blind spot of the movement. Personally, I struggle almost daily with reconciling my political beliefs with what I believe to be the most fruitful for the future of my field, basically feeling like a hypocrite, thinking of my time working towards my PhD being funded by tax money while advocating less taxes. Does this make sense? If you have the time, could you please point me towards some resources that explain a libertarian perspective on how the advancement of scientific research would function without public funding? Now, my main issue is that research is inherently wasteful, so a profit motive doesn't really function in this field except for certain industries. My time in the private biotech arena showed me that quite clearly how genuinely interesting scientific questions are quickly glossed over and ignored because they don't have the short-term ability to make a company money. This seems to play into the hand of the publicly funded wing of academic research, where basic questions can be asked without the need to turn a profit or sell a product. Anyway, I'd love to hear your take. So, Maya, what say you?
I really got into this. Now, probably one of the best resources, if you really want to get into more of a philosophical point of view on this, is read Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. There's a great deal of the book that deals with this topic and the whole idea behind it. As far as from like a libertarian perspective, you bring up the part about it doesn't have ability to turn a profit, so you know the market isn't going to really, you know, want to really get into R&D and everything else, and that's not necessarily true. There's many different people out there that have boatloads of money that love to learn, that love to see scientific progress, and will hire people and hire incredibly large research development firms to look up stuff just for their – they might find a way to turn it into money. They might not. But advancements in sciences in one area can always lead to advancements in other areas. So it's kind of myopic to say that, you know, just because that one instance in scientific research can't turn a profit isn't necessarily saying that it can't – well, maybe not short term, but it still doesn't matter.
And history bears that out because it's only relatively in the short term that we've seen most of these scientific research facilities funded by the federal government and grants. Throughout the rest of human history, we've seen private money funding research and art and other venues that don't necessarily turn an immediate profit.
And also, like, the Rockefeller Institute, for much of – the early part of the 20th century, they funded the discovery of the penicillin. Penicillin right. doesn't come about without the Rockefeller Institute, that's now the Rockefeller University, and then also the mapping of the Human Genome Project, both things privately funded. A guy in the 90s wrote a book, I think his name was Keeley. He wrote a book, I'll look it up and we'll put it on the podcast, that only about 10% of scientific breakthroughs since the federal government began to funding science are attributable to the research they performed.
Actually, well, tweet that out at We Are, the letter R, We Are Libertarians. So tweet that out.
Okay.
Greg.
I've got one long point to make.
Okay.
And this deals with the economics and everything else. First, I'll start with a quote from Andrew Stockton, which is a character in Atlas Shrugged, and it says, "Any man who's afraid of hiring the best ability he can find is a cheat who's in a business where he doesn't belong. To me, the foulest man on earth, more contemptible than a criminal, is the employer who rejects men for being too good." And that's kind of a good lesson as far as from that book and that particular character, if you have read it, is that a good company will hire the best of the best to progress their company. Now, every company, especially big companies, look at places like Intel, Apple, Windows, Microsoft, all that, is that they have a whole bunch of research development departments that make probably 90% of what those guys research and make never gets turned into a product. Not right away, but the progress itself can lead to many things down the road. And in a libertarian market, you would have more long-term seeking companies rather than short-term, because long-term profitability is much more important than the short-term. In a free market, longevity is the king that rules. Now, people believe it needs to be, you know, publicly funded, or it would all turn into like trade secrets and nobody would give it out. It wouldn't be accessible. That you need the government to fund it to keep IP and patent laws and trade secrets and all the laws there to keep it public, which isn't necessarily the case, which historically had been the case. Scientific research is an accumulation of many different studies and reports. It requires a great many different people, minds, different companies to advance any one subject. Thus, it is if a company wants to have its researchers be the best, it needs to be able to put its research out there to see other minds touch on it and expand on it. Because, well, you look at the scientific field, it's not usually an accumulation of everybody's work so much as it's one guy going, oh, look at all those things. I'm going to turn this into something massive, a.k.a. Nikola Tesla. And most of his research was privately funded. And who, you know, a lot of the greatest minds of all of our time, not until recently, were all either really weird guys that somehow got money their own way. They sold a couple ideas so they could fund the rest of their research, or they were just gifted. They convinced other people to give them money to do the research.
So let me ask you about Tesla, because Tesla is one of the tragedies of scientific history. Here is an absolutely brilliant guy who goes to work for Edison, who, you know, gets a lot of props in what I would call pop history. But when you really get down to it, he stood on the shoulders of the giants that he paid and worked for him. And so Tesla died broke because Edison basically took his research, and Edison knew how to market. Tesla was the genius. In our own day and age, Steve Jobs and Wozniak is a direct correlation. So,
to a degree, but what the thing?
So is that fair? Wouldn't public research make it more fair? Maya?
No. What Edison did is he had Westinghouse, which was government backed. It was a government collusion into the private industry. So Westinghouse and Edison had a partnership. Half the ideas that Tesla came up with, he was working under Edison. But because of how the company was structured, the government either instantly took the ideas and the blueprints and the patents, or they restricted them. And Edison was connected with a bunch of really evil people and the government, so any idea he took, he instantly threw a patent on it, and it was his. That's why Tesla went down broke, and, well, he kind of drove himself slightly insane, but, you know, not being able to kill the person that's stealing your life's work, that's kind of depressing. But Tesla, even most and some of the greatest scientific minds from that time, wanted to publicly share their information. They didn't want patents. I mean, that's one of the troubles that got with like people like Bill Gates and Microsoft and some other companies, that they weren't like, we're not going to be, you know, grubby people. We're not going to put patents all over everything. No, we're not going to copyright every single thing, until they found out that there's evil people like Steve Jobs that would throw government on top of everything he did and then try to steal other people's work with government force. And so that's why.
Hold on, though. That's misrepresentative history. Jobs got the idea for the graphic user interface, like, you know, why we don't have you don't type from the command prompt anymore.
Yeah.
At Xerox PARC, he saw it before Gates. He designed it, designed the graphic user interface for Macintosh, and Gates took it from him. That's where Gates got the idea. Both of them got it from Xerox.
Right. No. It's when you start throwing patents on things.
Oh, yeah.
There are no original ideas, ever. Mm-hmm. Period. Just never. But if a company can make something better, and that's where it comes down to people like Tesla. Yeah, if Tesla and Edison both were on a level playing field in a free market and did not have government-backed corporations or the government interfering, whoever could market best or could make the best product would win. Now, Tesla probably would have, on their own, Tesla probably would have attracted more great minds, which means he would have had more ideas and better products. Edison was a dickhead. He wasn't that smart, and he stole most of his ideas from other people. So, and I mean, he used horrible marketing tactics to crush Tesla. But then again, that's not necessarily something that could happen in a free market because he was government backed.
Oh yeah, absolutely. The other great example is Orville and Wilbur Wright. Discovered flight, the federal government had spent millions and millions of dollars with the top engineers, scientists, and researchers in the world trying to develop flight. It's a couple brothers in Ohio. Beat the hell out of them on a shoestring budget.
Right.
Well, and then the other thing is with as far as how a libertarian market would deal with everything, is that competition is what drives a free market. To be competitive, you have to constantly improve upon your product. The cell phone market and the computer in the tech world is probably one of the best examples of the free market because there's the least amount of restrictions because it's still new and they haven't made them yet.
The problem is the IP law, though, with like software.
That's with software and everything else. And now they're finding ways around it by creating brand new products. Brand new things have never existed, a.k.a. Google Glass, new kinds of software, flexible screens, all kinds of stuff. And so they're moving it. But one of the neat things about what libertarians – I'm sure there's books out there, and I just haven't seen them – is that Silicon Valley has historically outlawed moonlighting restrictions, meaning that if you quit or leave or have two jobs, you can work for another company doing the same thing. And so it's a giant melting pot of ideas and minds. And people hop around between massive Silicon Valley companies all the time. And it's that competition. It's not how can we crush our competitor. How can we make a better product? And only recently we've started seeing massive companies like Apple take everybody and their brother to court. And Samsung's doing the same thing. They're taking everybody they can to court because –
They don't have any new ideas, so we'll sue you for infringing on our ideas.
They're taking the easy way out.
Are there any new ideas? So, all right, So, I think any final quick thoughts on this issue?
Funding for basic discovery, scientific research would not go away. It would just be filled by the private market, and the people who actually want to benefit from it would instead of having it socialized.
It's like charity as well. I mean, charity, the need to help our fellow man, that impulse doesn't go away. And the more that we try to get the government to do charitable assistance, the less functional it becomes. You lose that sense of charity, and it becomes more bureaucratic and screwed up. When people see a direct need, when people see something in the world that needs fixed, we fixed it. That's the history of human history. Ever progressing towards a better man. You know, libertarians are not against progressivism in the sense that we want mankind to continually progress towards perfection. We just don't believe that the government should force everybody into perfection and that the government can't centrally plan perfection. Well, so, real quick thought.
Yeah, no, that's kind of what I'm going to say is that every time the government gets involved in something, it crushes true innovation. And I think
Because they restrict what they're funding, stem cell research. Perfect.
Well, and
point.
Then another thing, one more thing to add to the whole scientific, the grants and everything, is that people will drag something out for as long as humanly possible because the second they're done with their research and have an answer, they stop being funded.
To compare the innovation of the iPhone and the iOS program to the government healthcare exchange websites was incredibly offensive, Mr. President, and not even any kind of equivalent. You boob. Okay, so let's
boobs.
should this guy, he works in a field that has a lot of government funding, and there aren't, you know, the system is sort of moving towards public financing of his field. Should he feel guilty because he works for the government in a field or that he works for a company that takes government grants?
Yes.
Okay, why?
Government grants are not a natural thing. If the market wants to fund something or some rich billionaire wants to fund something, you go convince him to give you his money, period. Right now, people are having money stolen from them. Rich people are having their money stolen from them. And now, because it's not a market anymore where people actively go out and go, hey, that's really neat. Let's fund that, a.k.a. Red Bull, stuff like that. But now they got to do it in showy ways. But what you've done by taking grants and helping that system support itself and be supported and you consent to it is that you've helped crush and keep it crushed, the free market private investment.
So you're saying that morally he is participating in theft?
Yes.
That just because a group of people decided, 51% decided, that it was okay to steal, it still is wrong.
Yes, and that if he has such you know, if he thinks he's smart enough to get a PhD and thinks he's good enough to do his research, then he should be able to do it in the private sector and probably make more money and probably do something a little bit more relevant, because it, like I said, anytime you get a grant and you're working for a body, they do not want you to go quickly, and they want you to fit whatever the government grant was made for.
But just because he makes the personal choice to not participate in the system, somebody's still going to do that research. It's still going to. Why shouldn't he take the money from the government to feed his family and, hey, donate to the Libertarian Party?
Hey, man, we're at a party. That girl just got roofied. Three guys have already hit that. Three guys behind me are going to hit that. Why shouldn't I, too? It's going to happen anyways, right? What's one more?
That's really morally comparable to rape.
What, theft? Murder? Isn't? When people steal your money and they kill people with it and they literally rape the economy, that's not okay? Or when the CPS steals people's kids with your stolen money and then sell them on a sex slave market, you mean that's okay? That's not comparable to the same thing? It's
so
not?
So to maintain your integrity, which, anybody know what the word integrity means? I've had to learn that word the hard way this year.
Oh, I'm not going to even know. I was in the Air Force. We had to hear that word.
Integrity is exercising your personal principles in all situations, because if your personal principles become flexible, then by definition they're no longer principles. So if you don't believe in theft, then you shouldn't participate in a system that takes your money.
Willingly.
In Atlas Shrugged, for any Ayn Rand fans, it's when Hank Reardon says to the government-appointed inspector that watches everything in his factory, you're either eventually on our side or you're not.
Right. So you say willingly. What? Clarify that a bit.
Well, I'm going to willingly pay my speeding ticket, or I'm going to willingly, or I'm not willingly, I'm going to unwillingly pay my parking speeding ticket, or unwillingly pay my taxes, because there's a threat of violence. There's a threat of bodily harm as a consequence for not doing that.
Not paying your taxes,
yeah.
Not
so
consenting.
Yeah, if I don't pull over for that cop and I don't pay that parking ticket, I'm probably going to end up getting shot.
But you are not forced to take a job that is funded by the government.
No, and you can't even use the thing, well, I can't make enough income, I can't get my PhD, no.
Go work for Google. The founders are funding something to lasso a damn asteroid and mine it.
Look at Peter Thiel and like, everybody else, but no.
I mean, that's bigger than anything you could do.
Saying it's just your job, or that's your specialty, that's the only job you could find. Making poor life choices on what to study in school is not a valid excuse to willingly support a corrupt and evil system.
Okay, anything you can say, Greg Linz, to make this poor guy feel better?
One, I get it. You're incentivized in this system, and maybe your field, you can only get by taking government contracts. And if that's the case, hey, you got to do what you got to do. Everybody has to feed their family. I'm not going to be mad at you. Just, you know what? If you're going to do that while you're there, try to change people's minds, and then you can still abide by your principles.
What you should do is take, say, 80% of the money you make there, 80% of it, 80% of the profits. Actually, you know what? All the profits you make after you pay your income or your bills or support your family or whatever, donate it to, say, We Are Libertarians.
No.
No, no.
And support a cause that is fighting against a system you're willingly consenting and supporting.
Yeah, I don't want to guilt trip.
Be a Snowden of scientific research.
Yeah.
I advise.
I don't want to guilt trip him
Maybe
into.
Maybe burn down the building you're in. Who
no.
knows?
No, I don't want to guilt trip him into going to WeAreLibertarians.com, scrolling to the bottom, and hitting the PayPal button.
Do
but,
it.
No. So, sorry, I'm sure that wasn't the answer that you were looking for, but we had Maya on the show, so
well, it hopefully
usually
it made
isn't.
You think.
Yep. Or he's not listening to this part. Okay, on to Travis. Travis writes, I think a good topic for a show would be what would be the best way to be a libertarian politician? Not just spreading the word. How would a libertarian politician run a campaign? What would be the best way he or she could reach the people who might agree fundamentally with what we believe, but have been so headstrong being the patriot or a social worker, that they have not really had a chance to open their eyes. How do we in the movement reach out to them?
Rupert for governor.
I was the executive director of the Libertarian Party of Indiana. And over the course of 4 years, I advised hundreds of candidates on this very question. And let me give you the advice that I would give to any candidate running for office. First, you don't want to be a libertarian candidate, okay? And I mean that in a couple different ways. First, you don't want to be anybody that you're not. So you need to be yourself. You know, Rupert Bonham from Survivor, you know, he's known for his tie-dye. He's got a wild haircut. You know, he's got a brand in his image. And in the beginning of his campaign, for one of the first stops, they put him in a polo shirt. And he wore a polo shirt to one of his campaign events.
It was horrible.
And it was a horrible event because people came up and they said, "Where's your tie-dye? Are they changing you?" And Rupert's like, "I am the they." And he realized that he wasn't being true to himself. So, you know, in the debates, he wore a tie-dye tie. You know, he had the tie-dye handkerchief. So there still was a hint that he was himself. But it was a struggle because you've got to balance who he is and his brand versus, you know, what people expect. So people have a certain expectations of a politician. You have to fit within that politician's box. You can push the edges a little bit, but you can't really go outside of the box before people stop accepting you. There's a nice little balance that you have to achieve. And it kind of is part of, if you run for office, you really have to know who you are and what your boundaries are, what your principles are. You've got to know yourself really well. You've got to have your family on board because it really, you know, even as a libertarian in a council race, man, it pushes all your buttons, it pushes all your boundaries, and it causes a lot of problems within your family. But you have to be true to who you are. You know, people see through stunts. If you're trying to do stunts, if you're showing up to a debate in a Hawaiian shirt with a guitar and you're going to sing every answer because that's going to get you noticed, that isn't going to help you. Getting noticed isn't the virtue. Getting noticed and actually connecting with the people that might vote for you is the virtue. That is the point of the exercise. Politics is about identifying your voters, communicating to your voters, and then ensuring those voters get to the polls. That is the bottom line for Libertarian candidates, Republican candidates, Green Party candidates, politics in general. Know who you're speaking to, communicate and connect, and make sure they do the action that you want them to do. Okay, so Libertarian candidates have to apply political science to their campaigns. Traditional political science methods work. Political science isn't dirty in and of itself. It's how you use it.
Ew.
Are you acting with integrity? Are you telling the truth? Are you being true to yourself? Are you saying the things that you actually believe? Are you giving a positive vision for the future, or are you smearing the candidates? Are you lying about your positions? Are you hiding some part of yourself that you'd hate to be discovered? So by being yourself, by being natural, by being personable, going out and being likable, by connecting with people, showing that you're a normal person running for office, because they're going to see you and, you know, you look normal. Politicians just, they're like aliens. They don't look normal for whatever reason. They'll smell the normal on you, and you can connect with them, and they'll ask you questions. And when they ask you questions, you better have informed answers. You know, it's...
But not too informed. It has to be the right level of information.
Right. There's a delicate balance there, too. You know, this podcast, we're doing, you know, Maya did a little prep work. We looked at the answers. We thought about this a little bit beforehand. But by and large, when we're sitting here and we're talking at 1 hour and 18 minutes, we're pulling most of this stuff out of our memory because this is our craft. You know, we don't necessarily get paid for it, but this is our hobby. We study. We know what we're talking about. So if we're out on the campaign trail and somebody asks us what we think about the income tax, we know what we think about the income tax because we've thought about what we think about the income tax. You have to be, you know, an inch and a half deep and a mile wide. You have to know a lot about a lot of things. You have to not answer the questions that aren't pertaining to your office, and you have to say, listen, I'm running for city council. What I believe about abortion does not matter. And you have to... Well, that's a cop-out. I'm sorry. I'm going to stay... You know, the state's treasurer office does not affect abortion whatsoever. I'd rather not really get into it. Do you have any questions pertinent to... You know, that person, honestly, you've lost, and it doesn't matter. Because if you don't give them the answer that they want to hear, they're not going to vote for you, but they probably weren't voting for you anyway. So...
Ask them what they think. Turn it back on them in those situations.
Exactly. Most of the time, the people who are decidedly the patriot or the social worker or the Obama fan or the Republican fan, the people who want to come up and try and trap you, don't even waste your time with those people. Just don't, even in your personal life, if you're not running for office, if you're just a regular Joe and there's the hardcore liberal who just posts on your Facebook anti-libertarian stuff, like, don't even argue with that person. Just...
Ask them to define fair, and then you can begin the discussion.
No, right. just post some Stefan Molyneux's videos of, you know, his rebuttals to questions, and 3 hours later, they'll probably leave you alone.
No, I'd believe in not casting your pearls before swine. Pearls, things of value, do not belong in front of pigs.
Tell them just define fair, and we'll go from there. We'll run.
No, tell them to go away. So,
tell him to go die in a fire, go play in traffic. Something like I do, like go home and kill yourself.
Really?
So,
that's
scorched earth.
Now,
I'd say
the number one rule I think we found out, I've really found out on the Rupert campaign versus like Phil Miller's campaign, is that only talk to people that actually vote. Do not, as a libertarian candidate under the Libertarian Party, ever think you're going to convince new people to vote. Only talk to people that have historically voted as early as last year. Don't ever go out there and think that you're going to convince two people to sign up to vote. It's not going to happen. Sorry. Don't even try to base your numbers off that, because you're going to fail real hard.
There's two kinds of politics, trying to sway the independents and trying to get your base to turn out. And when you're the Libertarian Party, it's all about getting your base to turn out.
All right, so hopefully you find that to be helpful.
Beards and tie-dye, that's basically what I heard you say.
Beards and tie-dye.
Yeah.
All right, the next three questions come from our good friend Samantha, and I'm not even going to attempt her last name, because last time I attempted it, I probably offended her, and I don't want to do that because we love her to death. She listens to all the programs, and she's awesome.
To quote Sean Hannity, she is a great American.
That's right. She writes, can you guys talk a little bit about the California idea to license illegal immigrants for driving? What's the reason behind it? Who proposed this? Did they think anyone would do it? I always appreciate when you all address the topic of open borders. Maya, go.
Well, my stance is that there should not be illegal immigrants in the first place. So... But the licensing, I actually don't have a major issue with licensing. I wish all states did it, because if the legal immigrants are going to be here, regardless of what anyone tries to do to stop them, well, let's at least get them licensed, maybe. And so when they're driving down the road, maybe having that license will help them get insurance or something. And when they run into your car, they won't be so likely to flee the scene.
This sounds awfully like a tracking database that you want to acquire.
Why would I ever? I have all the tracking databases I need.
No, I know you do, but I'm saying it looks like a good way for the government to track who, in fact, is an illegal immigrant and asking them to self-identify.
But they're here illegally. Who cares? And all the administrations past have been for the past 20 years have been extremely friendly to illegal immigrants.
Oh yeah, but the federal government
talking about making 32 million of them have the ability to vote all of a sudden. So,
but the federal government's who I worry about. If I'm an illegal immigrant and I self-identify, I bet you there's a court somewhere that would rule that the federal government gets access to that database. Because right now, this
they're
going
to have access to it anyways.
Yeah, probably.
And honestly, they probably have access to it. Remember, they track people that buy sinus medicine at CVS,
yeah,
for God's sake. You think they don't know who all the illegal immigrants are? Do you really?
Why make it easier for them is all I'm saying.
Okay, who is it? Who's it hurt more when someone had done a valid ID and a license? I think it helps the illegals out and everyone else that has to deal with them when they can have a valid driver's license.
But by definition, is it valid when it's illegal and they're here illegally?
It's up to the state, isn't it?
Oh, no, it is. Like right now, there's nothing to worry about, right? California's not going to do anything to them.
No,
the federal government right now.
But the thing is that this is why this is a hard topic to talk about and be kind of, you know, ideologically pure on it, is because there shouldn't be illegal immigrants in the first place. But you know, Chris?
I was in the bathroom. What were you saying?
Oh, there shouldn't be illegal immigrants in the first place. My argument was, why self-identify when the federal government probably has access to that database? And right now, yes, you have nothing to worry about. With Brown and the president, and they're on your side. The thing is, those people aren't always in power. And so now you've got a database of self-identified illegals, and it might
but
be someone who isn't
people
as
that are
happy
to be
drive
with you. And legally allowed to drive. They're in the system for drivers. And that could help with insurance, because if to be able to drive and get insurance, or to be able to drive, you have to have insurance, right? So driver's license equal insurance means safer driving and more insured drivers, does it not? Wouldn't it help everyone else?
Hey, I 100% agree with you. It's just it's like we talked about earlier. All they do is got to do is get the foot in the door. They have the foot in the door now. Now they know where you are. And hopefully it never comes to a point.
Are you saying that illegal immigrants never get online?
No, they get online all the time.
Government knows about them. Pointless.
I see, whenever we debate illegal, not here, but nationally, like, I really just feel like it's just, well, we shouldn't let the brown people do what they want. Like, that's sort of the way that it always comes across. It's like, really, do you truly give a crap if an illegal immigrant has a driver's license, or are you just rabbling about something that Sean Hannity told you to rabble about? Like, insurance, there's a huge problem with illegal immigrants getting into car accidents and not helping pay for the accident because they hit and run and they drive away because they're afraid of getting caught for a multitude of reasons.
Being deported.
Right. And it just seems to me that it wouldn't... it's just not something I care about. Like, because I totally hear and understand Maya's argument, and it goes back to the nationalism we discussed with Lincoln. Like, the whole idea of nationalism causes so many problems in the first place. Our immigration system is broken. That's why people come here illegally, because we have let the federal government control immigration, and that's why it sucks. And, you know, people come here for an economic opportunity, and I just don't think, like, you know, my great-great-great-grandfather who moved to Freelandville, Indiana, I don't think he really was worried about a driver's license when he was driving the truck around on the farm.
Well, it's like,
he was responsible enough to drive a truck because he's a human being. He knows what he's doing. He's not an idiot that needs your permission to drive on the roads. My roads! You know, so I just look at it and I go, really, why are we pissed off about this at the end of the day? Now, immigration, you know, this is one of the questions that libertarians have a tough time with, because there is the pure perspective that Maya is offering. But if you're president of the United States, there's that pragmatic argument of what can you get done. But really, I side more with Maya. I didn't hear your argument.
My argument was, why self-identify if you don't have to? I took the less statist argument.
Right.
Well,
just called you a statist.
I'm just saying, like, I wouldn't self-identify. You're not a statist. No way.
I was saying it from a societal, as a whole issue looking at it. I would prefer, if I have to follow these rules and for insurance and for safety and everything else, if that's the way the system works, why not? And that brings him one step closer. But I had a friend in New Mexico that owned two small successful businesses, had come over here on a visa from I don't think the country even exists anymore in Europe, years ago. And
Bosnia, Herzegovina, Yugoslavia.
It was a while ago. Shut up. And two successful, successful businesses. I don't ever talk about the companies in Europe because I can't pronounce half of them correctly. but the guy had stayed over here, passed his visa, and liked it here. Just couldn't get another visa. Was screwed. Had to stay here. And ended up losing his passport. Well, he couldn't get a hold of his consulate, couldn't get a new passport, so he had no idea. He couldn't go to bars. He couldn't go. He couldn't do a lot of different things because he didn't have an ID. He couldn't get a state-issued ID. He couldn't get anything. He was stuck here, and he was a successful business owner, but we should tell people like that, well, you know what, just try to hide. You can't do business with your bank anymore because you don't have any valid ID, but you know what? You know what? Just you're hiding now, so you're good. Don't be a statist and self-identify, or, you know, well, we're gonna deport you now, screw your businesses.
He's Tom Hanks in that movie where he's stuck in the airport for
yeah
years.
But I mean, it's whatever, give him a freaking ID.
What's that? What are you
None
showing
of your
him?
Business.
What you just show him, or I swear to God, I'm going to put a bolt in your nose.
You'll have to listen to Wall After Dark, and you can find out our secrets there. By the way, we are anticipating at any moment the return of Gina Martinez. So Gina has texted me and said she'll be here in 45 minutes, roughly 40 minutes ago. Now
I locked the door.
The Madam of Wall.
Right. I'm like, seriously, We Are Libertarians will be over by then. But Gina's a free spirit, so we don't judge. Okay, enough of that. Let's go on to the next question from Samantha. On another topic I would love to hear from the show, maternity leave. Also known as the Family Leave Act. In other countries with socialized health care, women get 1 year of leave, some paid, some unpaid. What would a libertarian system look like? If a woman got pregnant, could a boss just replace her when she left due to complications or to have the baby? Do you think offering maternity leave for 6 weeks hurts women or employers? Just curious to hear how libertarians would work with this. Let's go to our female correspondent on the show, Maya Axton.
Well, I don't think maternity leave is something that should be enforced by law. I think it's something that someone can contractually go to a company with. It's as far as, you know, maybe being fired and, you know, getting replaced the second you get pregnant or you leave for maternity leave. A company, why would somebody invest in somebody and then fire them because they're going to be gone for a couple weeks? People break their legs. People get hurt all the time. I mean, there's not a I broke my leg act. But if a company's going to have temporary replacement for you, that's guaranteed. Now, you know, if that new temporary replacement happens to learn quicker than you and ends up being better and is working for less, of course they're probably not going to hire you back. That's just common sense. But as far as enforcing a certain period of time for maternity leave or anything else, no, it should be a company policy. If a company doesn't want to treat female employees that want to start a family good, then don't work for them. They don't want to treat you well, go work somewhere else. I'm sure a competing company in a libertarian world would be like, hey, we have great maternity leave packages here and great kinds of, you know, everything. And then they would fight for your expertise and your services. That's that. But I mean, as far as is it a good thing for the market to give women maternity leave? Oh, hell yes it is. I mean, why would you treat people poorly? It's like, hey, you have a broken leg, and I know you have to stand for your job all day, but we need you back to work on Tuesday, and it's Monday, so, you know, get it healed quick. No. Companies that treat people extremely well get the best employees, period. I think that's mainly from an economic standpoint and libertarianism, that's their standpoint. Treat employees good, have good employees. Treat your employees like crap, you get crap employees.
Unfortunately, we don't live in that system, which was what... That's what sucks.
Well, as far as now, I still don't think we should enforce maternity leave by law, especially not up to like a year. Because that's a company basically having to keep somebody on their payroll. Does that, depending on the law, does that apply towards retirement? Is that person now going to get 6 extra free months that nobody else gets? You know, I mean, if you're going to work for a company, find out what their maternity leave is before you get hired on there.
No, but we have established precedent of societal benefit. So realistically, with our immigration policy, we're very restrictive, right? So you need population growth in order to fund your entitlement programs. So like that's why France pays their mothers to have children. And that's why they get to be stay-at-home moms.
And that's why China murders their children.
They had too many.
Yeah.
So we look at it as, well, when you have restrictive immigration policy, you need population growth or else Social Security, even though it starts as 23 or 25 to 1 originally.
The pyramid schemes that we have.
Yeah. Now it becomes 2 or 3 to 1. You need that population growth. And if you don't incentivize it, you're either opening up your borders or you're paying women to have babies.
So what you're saying is that the government shouldn't have any laws that deal whatsoever with population control, including immigration and or... maternity issues?
Population control, absolutely not. Immigration issues, it depends on how many enemies you have. For the United States, no, for the United States, it's impossible to say we don't have enemies that would like to come here and blow up a mall like in Nairobi. So, I mean, you do have to be a little bit pragmatic.
There's a lot of gun owners in malls these days. Even though Simon Properties says you're not allowed to bring guns into any of their properties, I see at least 2 concealed carry people in a Simon mall every time.
you know, part of it, it's a larger economic question because the government has been so we intervene in the government, or the government intervenes into the free market so often, or what I guess we could call a free market, the private sector, so often that it hurts jobs. The amount of regulations, the taxes, the laws that we've got, things like OSHA, they hurt jobs. Obamacare kills jobs. Also, corporate taxes, for instance. Okay, and I know I sound like I'm being tangential here, but I have a point. Corporate taxes are double taxation. Okay, so when they charge a company like Maya's or Greg's or the company that I work for...
Not ours, just C corporations.
Yeah. They are taking money out of your pocket directly. So when they have to pay taxes, they've got three options of paying those additional taxes. Okay, they can take it out of investor shares. So they can take it out of the shares that they're going to pay back to investors. So it makes them a bad investment property. So it makes it harder to raise capital. So they're not going to do that. They could raise their prices. They're not going to do that because that makes them less competitive. Or they can just slowly dwindle down their workforce, put more of the responsibility onto the employees that they have, pay their employees less, give them less raises.
Or have a great accounting firm.
Right.
Like Facebook and Google and Apple that somehow managed to pay 1%.
Because, hey, favors are cool. So, you know, that's why we're now at a point where if you are a great employee for your company, you're rewarded with an awesome 25-cent raise every year. So, you know, the economics of our society means that our bosses have less margins to work with, so they are less charitable. You know, most of the people in this country work for small businesses. 70% of the people, I think it's around 75-78% of the people in this country work for a small business. My dad is a small business owner. Greg is a small business owner. Maya is a small business owner. I work for a small business. You ask any small business owner in December, are you waiting for an invoice to be paid so you can buy your family Christmas presents? And I guarantee most of them will say yes. I'm waiting to get some small bit of profit to pay my family. If you look at Obamacare, you look at insurance, there are very few business owners that if they could give their employees insurance, they would. They'd give them 100% if they could, if it was financially possible. Most people who own businesses are caring people, and they care about the people that work for them. Well, not Greg. He has Cratchit working for him.
All you have to do is remove my compliance costs, and I'd cover every dime.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah. People want to do good for their employees, and we have turned out...
Because they're good, and I want to keep them.
Right.
Well, and to be good to your employees means productive, happy, hardworking employees, which means a better profit line. Plus, if you start treating your employees like crap and they go out and they go, hey, everybody, this company sucks, stop working there, or no, stop eating there, stop buying from them, or if they convince other employees to leave, the company fails.
And they get crappy employees that go work for them, their service is crappy, the market then spits them out, they fail, and then they move on.
And
so
the biggest thing of all that is the autonomy. That is what keeps employees. You can offer below market wages if you offer enough autonomy. Set your own hours. Just do what I ask you to do. And my industry, the financial industry, makes it damn near impossible to do that. I have to monitor, regulate, watch all the time. And so you end up getting a salesman that's fantastic saying, God, the things I have to do in my day-to-day life, like all the notes I have to keep, all the tracking I'm under – I'm going to go join a different industry. And it's nothing, it's not pay, it's nothing but that autonomy.
Well, and one more thing that you have to look at is when you start enforcing these things by law with like anti-discrimination and maternity leave laws and everything else, is that you now force bad employers and bad companies to just skirt by, and then that's what they do. And then they find ways and loopholes to treat you like crap and to treat you poorly or find a way to fire you because you're pregnant. And instead, you're blindsided because you thought there was some special governmental protection that would stop that from happening.
You are putting your trust, instead of putting your trust in the person that you have direct contact with and putting your personal livelihood, your body, literally your body and the body of your loved one, instead of the person that you've engaged in a voluntary relationship, You have now forced that person. You've used coercion to force that person to do something for you, where had they had the choice to do something, they probably would give you more time. They probably would give you a year off if you needed it. The government, part of the question here, and I don't mean this personally, but you see this all the time, part of it is people are just scared. They're scared of a society without a government to protect them. And as soon as you try to roll back and you make this argument that, excuse me, I've got the hiccups tonight. As soon as, you know what I'm trying to say, can you say?
Yeah, no, as soon as you start rolling these things back in the mails, you see what companies we have right now. And yes, right now with the current lot of companies and corporations we have, it would be downright frightening, scary, and crappy to not have a government there. But the neat thing is that without the government holding down the good guys, because good guys don't use the government and become corrupt and turn and use the government to grow. That's the bad guys using it to hold the good guys down. The good guys would grow. The market would be a lot more free. The good people, the people that treat their employees right, made superior products, would win out in the end. Big companies could not exist in a free market without the enforcement of their government partners. So it'd be a rough transition, yeah, and that's why I kind of am against incrementalism, because for some people it'll hurt for a lot longer than others. But no, I mean, it's, you got to think of it that way, is that things would change pretty quickly in the marketplace, because remember, the government controls most of everything. That's why everything looks like it moves super slow when it's not necessarily that way in the real world. But there's plenty of companies out there would be more than willing, especially when they get to hold on to all of their profits and employees get all of their money. Things would be a lot different. You got to think of all the other factors. So I think some people's fears are somewhat founded in reality, and then others, they need to think a little bit deeper and harder about why are they really afraid of what they're afraid of. So,
all right. So, yeah, don't worry. Be happy.
And right. That was about paid maternity leave. So,
yep.
Sorry.
You don't care?
Tangent. No, I'm saying own it that you made a personal decision to build a family. That's your decision. Society doesn't owe you anything for making that.
All right. Well, you're going to beat her over the head with the club and then take her back to your cave there, Greg? All right. On to... No, I'm just kidding.
Misogynist!
Yeah. Why do you hate women? War on women. Greg Linz, general in the army.
I'm owed a rib. I'm getting it back.
All right.
Adam and Eve.
On to our final question, and I'm praying that one of you actually studied this because I didn't. All right. There is a bill in Georgia that makes bike owners register and tag their bikes.
As of the 8th, it didn't pass.
Okay.
Not anymore.
We'll talk about the idea of it then.
Right. Bull S, as she says. Bull S. It had to do with restricting cyclists from riding on certain roads, making them ride single file, and making them ride in lines of no longer than 4 persons. And it was proposed by 3 Republicans. Asinine! So much for smaller government. Now, before I turn it over to Maya, who ran a bike courier service here in the 12th largest city in the nation, I hate bicyclists. You're all a bunch of a-holes. Get out of my way. Stop thinking that I'm paying attention to you and cutting in front of me and veering with me. I don't want to kill you on purpose. But that being said,
you know what? For a while there, I really agreed with you until I started riding the bike,
right,
in downtown Indianapolis, delivering packages between pedestrians who are all very overweight, fat, and take up way more room than they should. And they walk arms like a half arm's distance away from each other, and they take up all the sidewalks. You can't ride on the sidewalk, and the only sidewalks that are in decent repair are the ones that they've spent millions of dollars on and called them cultural trails. All the rest of them are in complete and utter disrepair and can't be ridden on. And then you've got bike lanes, which cross over into other lanes and just kind of randomly disappear and are way more dangerous than actual riding in lanes. It's turned into, let's ride our bikes in the lanes, and if a car hits us, we get out and we break their rear mirror off, side view mirror off. You know, I'm kind of hit and miss for cyclists that like to go ride down country roads with like 300 of them and take up the entire road on their $5,000 bikes. Well, you know what? You know, I have to go a speed limit. I have to stay on one side of the road or the other in a car. I have to do certain things. There's a minimum safe following distance. Think of all the restrictions they do on how you drive your car on the road. So if they can restrict cars and motorcycles so much, why can't they restrict bicyclists as much? Doesn't that just seem to make sense? You know, bicyclists want cars to drive safer, right? Well, we just want bicyclists to be safer too, you know? But honestly, I like the idea that they've been trying to implement in England, where it's basically there are no rules on the road. They took like an intersection where like six roads turn into like a big oval and then go places. They took away all lines, all lights, all signs, and they just said, "Hey, intersection coming up, deal with it." And the amount of crashes, pedestrians and bicyclists getting hit dropped drastically because people were forced to pay attention.
Was that like near Piccadilly, like right downtown London?
Or yeah, I don't know. They didn't test it in like a major city. It was a test. So it wasn't like, hey, downtown London, let's test it out. There's a couple million cars go by here today. No, that'd be stupid. Shut up.
They did do one there, and it worked really well.
So they started really trying to implement it more places, but bicyclists out on country roads and roads that aren't necessarily made for bikes and are just out there getting their exercise in, don't be an idiot. Get the hell off the road. Don't ride at night in all black. You know, I know you have this really cool $4,000 200 speed bike because you're actually not in that good of shape.
Hey,
you know, maybe you shouldn't ride in like four across 20 deep. That's just, you know, I can't drive a semi down that road because there's weight restrictions and size restrictions. Maybe you should follow the same rules. And then bikes downtown, that's a completely different world. It depends on the city, but like a city like Indianapolis and most cities, you can't ride a bike on a sidewalk. You can't ride a bike on a trail, and you can't ride a bike in a bike lane because none of them are safe. And they don't cover everything. Think of how few bike lanes there are in Indy and how few trails there are in Indy. You can't go anywhere.
Literally, I didn't have to do any editing for this podcast at all. You walk in for
bullshit.
The first time, and now I have to edit. You've been gone for a month. It's taken me like no time at all to post these podcasts. I loved it, but I have missed you, Gina.
Likewise.
All right. That's enough of that. So, nannyism, you don't need people to protect you.
Bikes, if you're out there, you're a target. Get over it.
Yep. No, you know what?
I'm going to hit you
if you're
a Canadian.
If you're a car driver, it's your duty to pay attention to the road because you're in a giant metal machine. So maybe you should pay attention to the road and the bikes. The bikes can maneuver better than you. So just watch your. You know what? I'm gonna have people look up for your car downtown. And if you do anything weird around a bike, you're not gonna have any glass on your car.
Attention, all Indianapolis residents. If you see someone with pink hair on a bike, run them over immediately.
You will be shot because I ride with a gun.
You will be rewarded for taking down Indianapolis's most notorious social terrorist. All right.
The Bin Laden of social terrorism.
Yep. Okay. Soapbox round. This is where you get to say what is on your mind, something you'd like to promote, anything you'd like to rant about. Get up on your soapbox, Maya Axton.
I need tits, guys. I really do.
I swear, go to My Free Implants and we will link to it from the We Are Libertarian
site. You
want
My Free Implants?
No, we won't.
It's a webcam site. You basically strip and masturbate for people on camera so they donate money to you.
Just be waist high and above.
No,
keep it classy.
I need somebody to fund my breasts so I can fund my book with said breasts. Could you imagine the increased amount of ratings we'd get on this
program? I also will write
tits?
A book with very small breasts.
Gina, you're perfect the way you are. So are
Agreed.
You, Maya. You don't
need
Maya, boobs.
You are beautiful.
I need huge tits.
If Gina can do it, you can
right.
do it.
I mean, you're easily a B.
I'm 6 foot
cup.
One.
So?
She's like 4 foot one.
I'm 6 foot Stacked. And I'm rocking a B cup.
B, more like K. God damn. I mean, and Grego, there's about caught up with you.
I'm just saying, I'm sitting here with the smallest tits on the bench, not crying for implants.
Well, you're the smallest person here. You weigh like what? 74 pounds?
Maybe.
Okay. All right. So where can we donate to your boob fund?
Just find me on Facebook or call me, 317-938-2661.
I still just don't really see how, like, this benefits me in any way. If I give you money for boobs, how
you
does
get
it
pictures of them.
What am I going to do with pictures? Like,
if you donate, it's like, okay, it's like an Indiegogo thing. If you donate,
like
$5.
I don't go on.
Hold on. If you donate like $5, you get a picture. If you donate like 50, you get like a video. If you donate 500, you get touching privileges. If you donate 1,000, you get
motorboat.
No restrictions on touching
privileges. So you are way beyond myfreeimplants.com. You have broached that physical barrier,
not,
my friend.
No, I'm not. I'm said just, touching. What?
I'm just saying.
Shut up. Do it.
How much do I have to pay you to not have to do any of that?
$5,000.
All right. Greg, get up on your soapbox. Please save us.
There is no saving this episode. If you're still with us, seriously reconsider your life.
This seriously has gone into story time with Gina already. So, okay. Truly nothing.
Maya, thanks for being on again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, fuck you.
Okay. Well... This has been, this is, you know, really solid episode, and then, like, it just crashed.
Maya happened.
No, Gina happened.
That's
Gina's
right.
Gina's been
you
gone.
You know what? It's fitting she's been in New Orleans, because she's like her own little Katrina walking around. Why did you Katrina me, bro?
All right. So it has been a good episode, but as always, next episode, we promise.
To do better next time.
Not.
Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.